Hey, everybody, welcome to the show. Before we get to my guest this week, real quick, it's a big day for me. I ordered new underwear. I've got underwear that I've had for years. They're comfortable. They're stretched out. They're lucky. And if you're like me, you love your underwear. And my wife, about 6 months ago, was like, you got to get rid of this underwear. It's ridiculous. It's like Swiss cheese. And she may have a point. It has gotten to the point where my underwear is the size of that cloth you get to clean your eyeglasses. Basically, my underwear is like a loincloth for hamsters. That's how big it is. And so I went to MacWeldon.com. They're a new sponsor, by the way. So please listen, support them, because they help support this show and allows me to bring it to you. So I'd appreciate it. They got some really great stuff. Underwear, pants, shorts, hoodies. They believe in smart design, premium fabrics, simple shopping. It was really simple. I went on, 2-3 clicks, boom, I was done at MacWeldon.com. Trust me, it's going to be the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, hoodies that you'll ever wear. They have a line of silver underwear and shirts that are naturally antimicrobial, which means they eliminate odor. Trust me, you want friends. You don't want odor, all right? You want to be comfortable? You're going to be comfortable. If you don't like your first pair, you can keep it, and they will still refund you. No questions asked. Not only does Mack Weldon's underwear, socks, and shirts look good, they perform well too. Great for working out. I just got these pants called Radius pants. They're water resistant. They're like for travel and just running around. They got a lot of pockets. They're stain resistant, so which is good for me because usually I look like a Jackson Pollock painting after I eat. Really cool pants. I'm really loving what I got. I'm excited about the underwear. So it's really been a great experience. I would check them out, MacWeldon.com. Enter the promo code Paul. You get 20% off your first order. MacWeldon.com, promo code Paul, 20% off your first order, okay? Great stuff, comfortable stuff, new underwear. My wife's going to be happy. The world will be happy. MacWeldon.com. Use the promo code Paul, get 20% off your first order.
I just want to thank you for doing this, man. I've been doing this podcast because the world needs another comedian with a podcast.
That's right.
And I thought, I got to get Jay because, you know, you're the reason I got started in this business.
Yeah, we go back a long time.
I was a lawyer on Wall Street. Right. And I was writing jokes as a hobby. I don't know why. And you were performing for a private function for R.R. Donnelly and Company, which is a printer that opened up this huge worldwide headquarters down on Wall Street.
Yeah, that's right. I remember going down the basement. They printed like 50,000 books an hour.
Prospectuses for stuff like that. And I was doing corporate law and we worked with them. So because we worked with them, we were a client, they gave us some tickets. And I was a young associate. I'm like, I'm too busy. And the friend's like, come on, come. It's Jay Leno. I'm like, I was a huge fan of comedy at the time. I was a huge fan of yours. And I'm like, all right. And I had these jokes and I printed them out. And you performed and you were super nice and said, you know, hi to everybody afterwards. And I went up to you real sheepishly and I had these jokes and I'm like, I got jokes. And you took them, you were real nice. And then I got about 50 feet away and you go, hey, come back here. And I thought, oh, this guy's just going to give back to me. He goes, you may want to put your name and your phone number on here.
So yeah, that's right. Yeah, so you know.
Right.
You know how many people do that? Leno never called. Jerk. I gave. Yeah, there's no name. There's no, you know.
So I still think, you know, you were being nice and I'm never going to hear from you again. And 2 days later, I think you were there doing a gig at St. John's. You were there for like 2 or 3 days in New York.
Yeah, I don't remember what it was exactly.
And I come home and I got a list of messages. Your mother called, the dry cleaning's ready. Jay Leno called. I'm like, get out of here. I'm like, yeah. And you called and we played phone tag and we talked that night. And you read the stuff and you said, you know, it's clean. I'm looking for stuff for the Tonight Show. Start sending some stuff in. I'm like, really? I never expected to hear it. And then you said to me, what do you do for a living? I go, I'm a lawyer. And you started laughing on the phone. I knew it. I go, why? He goes, because your setups are way too long. You're too wordy.
Yeah. Protect yourself. Right. And that's the first. And when the plaintiff, well, I think when plaintiff, when I saw plaintiff in the setup, that's when I
literally was giving you stage direction, funny face here.
Yeah.
And so that, and then about a week later, you called me and you did one of my jokes, my first joke, the first one that you did from mine on the Tonight Show, and it blew my head off my shoulders.
No, that's funny.
And I went, we watched it, we got a bottle of champagne, my wife and I, and another couple, and it was just incredible. And it got me obsessed with writing jokes.
And so, now your parents hate me.
No, right, it's like, and so I had, you know, middle-class kids, much like you from New England, me from Rhode Island, you from Andover, Mass, Italian family. My father put floors in for a living. It's like, I made it, and now do I turn my back on this thing? But I I had no inkling this was coming. Like, in your case, I don't know. Did you know, like, in high school, like, this was your path? Did you know you were going
to? Well, I didn't know I didn't know what I would do, actually. My dad was an insurance salesman, and once a month, my dad would have to do a little something in the office to inspire the men, and there was all men selling insurance.
Yeah.
You know, like a funny show or some jokes, yeah. Or, you know, he'd play, like, the High Hope song by Frank Sinatra, and then he'd put his own lyrics in, you know, sell, you know, dealing with insurance. I thought, well, that's probably what I enjoyed helping him with that.
Right.
So I thought, oh, maybe that's what I'll do, get a job selling insurance where I could get to be funny. Right.
So you would, like, write some of the stuff with him?
Yeah, like, yeah. Little jokes and things. Yeah. I was a teenager, you know. It was more just to do stuff with
my dad. Were you funny with your friends? Were you, like, the funniest one among your friends?
Yeah, I guess I mean, there's a fine line between annoying and funny. But when you grow up in New England, I always remember the lady next door said, you know, you can't be a comedian unless your father was a comedian. That's the way it is in California. You can't just be a comedian. Your father has to have been a comedian. You know, I mean, everybody, it's one of the few professions people know nothing about it. Feel free to give this advice as if they've been in the business.
Well, the other thing you get is, so you're doing stand-up. So, like, when are you going to, you know, get bigger stuff? And, like, I think Colin Quinn made the point, like, isn't it just good enough to be, like, a really good stand-up? But, like there's no other profession where someone goes, okay, so you're an accountant, but when are you going to be a CEO someday? Like,
right,
they always want to bump you up to, like, a movie star, or TV star.
It doesn't work that way.
And so now you're, like, sort of just tinkering around with this stuff, and do you planning on going to college at this point, or, like, you know?
No, my parents wanted me to go to college, and I said I would. I went to Bentley School of Accounting and Finance for about a year, and that, because I'm dyslexic, I don't know why I went there. And then I went down to Emerson, and that was a real good school. But they didn't have a comedy program. At that point, Emerson was mostly about serious performing arts.
Yeah.
And comedy was not something. But I was working the Playboy clubs on weekends and doing stuff like that. So it's a great school, and it's even greater school now. But I just I didn't put a lot into it, so consequently I didn't get a lot out of it.
Yeah.
You know, I would drive to New York every night after class to perform at the Improv in New York.
Unbelievable.
So I didn't get home till 1:30 or 2.
Weren't you working on cars?
Yeah,
and
I was working
the cars you would work on and drive them down?
Yeah, I was working on 10 cars. I was working on, I'd drive to New York. Hey, this car's got 800 test miles. Yeah, most people never knew.
No one knew?
No, nobody knew 52,800 miles from 53,800. I mean, nobody looked.
Yeah, that's a lot. And you literally go out for the night,
do some sets? I go out for the night, yeah.
Well, but Boston wasn't it?
No, there really wasn't a lot in Boston. The Improv was the club. Don't forget, this was a time. I used to do colleges in Boston, but it was mostly Stop Your War Machine, you know, and guys with guitars and that kind of stuff. People really weren't doing comedy.
There weren't comedy clubs like
this. No, there were no. Yeah. The Improv, you know, the big joke was always a singer than you. That's what Bud would say. At the Improv in New York, you'd have four or five Broadway singers, then a comic. And in fact, after about the first 7 or 8 months, Bud would ask us to pretend to be people auditioning for the first time because there weren't enough people doing comedy. It just...
Really?
Well, it wasn't something people really did.
And this is before Catch a Rising Star. This is
Catch a Rising Star opened probably 70, 71.
Up on First Avenue, right?
Yeah.
Near the Green Kitchen.
Yeah.
Didn't you say you used to go and hang out at the
Green Kitchen, all those places? Upstairs, at the downstairs, the Bitter End, Cafe Wa, all those places. Blue Note. There was all kinds of clubs around. It was a different... See, back then, like in Boston, I used to play a place called Lenny's on the Turnpike.
I've heard of that name.
Goofy name. But I would open for like Miles Davis and these kind of people. But they would come in and they would do 6 nights in a 250-seat room.
Right.
And you got a steak dinner and Miles Davis and a comedian. It was $12.95.
Jeez.
You
know? Unbelievable.
And then suddenly, they started to put up theaters in the round and places that were like 3,400 seats.
Yeah.
So a Miles Davis could come in for one night
and make,
why stay a whole week?
Right.
You know, I remember what closed Lenny's on the Turnpike. He, biggest act he ever hired, Chris Christopherson, for like $15,000 for like 5 nights, which was huge money back in the day.
Yeah.
And it was a huge snowstorm. And nobody came. And Lenny kind of went broke.
Oh, jeez.
Because he had to pay the act and the band.
Yeah, you know.
And that was the end of that. And that was the fate of a lot of clubs. You know, there was Paul's Mall. These were cool little jazz places. Mr. Kelly's in Chicago.
Where the comedy was almost incidental to the music, right? It was sort of a little appetizer in a way to the main event.
I used to work burlesque strip clubs.
Yeah, what was it? Lenny Bruce did the same thing.
Like, yeah, and that was like, hey, peckerhead, get up. To stage, you know, that
nobody's paying attention to you, right?
No, like, I used to work with strippers, and I mean, it was an intro. We used to do army shows, and they I work with these two strippers, Lily Pagan and I Need a Man, and that's what it was, their names. But they weren't like whores or prostitutes. They were like women that didn't finish high school, that never learned to type.
Yeah.
And you really, you, back in those days, it was secretarial work or stripping. And it's old school stripping, you know, you know, 35 minutes, they'd come on in parkas and mittens and gloves, and as many clothes as you could wear. It wasn't like now they run out naked and turn around and run away. You know what I mean? It wasn't, attention spans are much greater.
Yeah.
And I would open for them, and that's what I would do. And it was, and it was terrible audiences. It was,
I was
going
to say, like, it's to the exponentially different, but in a way similar. Like starting out as a comic, open mic nights in these bar rooms where basically the only people in the audience are other comics or drunks that borrowed money on the street and came. So how are you honing your material?
Well,
in a strip club when nobody's paying attention.
The good thing was nobody was paying attention, so you didn't know how badly you sucked. You got stage time, and you just learned how to work the room. What I used to do in Boston was I used to go into bars with, I had $50 bills, and I'd say to the bar, I'm a comedian, can I get on stage? And they'd say, no, we don't do comedy. And I'd say, here's $50. If I do bad and people leave, keep the 50. If I do good and people laugh, give me the 50 back.
Wow.
And that worked. People go, okay. And they take the 50. I go on stage and I tell some joke, that was okay. Okay, you can come back next week if you want. Oh, okay. And that kind of worked.
Yeah.
Because you'd always, you know, and that worked for me. Okay.
Did you do some crowd work too to grab their attention?
Yeah, but you know, playing to audiences that couldn't care less was actually good practice because you just didn't know how bad you were. I remember the first time I went to Lenny's, I opened for Buddy Rich, and that was a jazz audience. They said, please welcome comedian Jay Leno. And the audience went, shh. Well, I had never walked on stage to silence.
Right.
And I realized, oh man, I'm not really that. This is really not funny.
Now, all eyes are on
now
you.
Now you start taping your material and honing it down and honing it down and honing it down.
Right.
You know, for comics, your whole life is usually your first 5 minutes. Your first 5 minutes will usually define the rest of your comedy career. What you do in that first 5 minutes of your stand-up kind of sets the tone for the kind of humor you're going to do. It all comes out of that.
You mean the first 5 minutes on any given night, on any given show?
No, or the first time you get on stage, whatever your first 5 minutes.
That's who you
I'm
are.
Not talking about memorizing a George Carlin routine or doing two guys going to a bar. I mean, whatever you choose to talk about, the first couple of times you get on stage, that sort of says who you are.
But some guys, like a George Carlin, had AMFM. I mean, he kind of completely went 180 and sort of grow into a different being.
He got freer, but it was basically, George Carlin was always funny.
Right.
It was just a different style of funny. But if you study comedy, you realize it was the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, the hippy dippy weatherman.
Wasn't
that different. He just became the hippie.
Always taking a shot at authority.
Yeah, he went from gentle shots to just, you know, power punches.
Yeah.
But it was always George Carlin, you know, and even when George Carlin was in the comedy team, it was the same thing.
How conscious of you early on were you of your voice and what my voice is and what it needs to be? Or do you just, as they say in sports, let the game come to you and eventually your voice kind of emerges from your writing and your stand-up?
Most comics are inherently pretty lazy, so you tend to gravitate to where the audience is. You know, I would always tell young comics in Boston, when you start to get popular here in Boston, get out, because it's a trap. Because there are guys in Boston that were making $1,000 a weekend, which was huge money, you know, 30
years. There's like five or six guys. There's Don Gavin, Kenny.
But what happened is, suddenly you go to New York City with your material on the mayor of Boston or your bit about the North End, and they don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
So that I realized, oh boy, people here in Boston are laughing. Let me go keep trying to find the place where they're not laughing and play that. You know, when I first came to town, I used to go on, I would follow Richard Pryor every night at the Comedy Store. Because I would say, put me on after Richie. And nobody wanted to go after Richie because he would blow the room out.
Yeah.
So I'd get up there and everything that was really funny before was kind of funny now. And everything that was kind of funny really sucked now. All right, so I got rid of all the stuff that really sucked. It made me tighten up my act.
Well, I was going to say, let the listeners understand why you would want to subject yourself to that and go up after a killer act.
Well, I mean,
like
I think if you're a runner, you start out running sprints, and then eventually you get to marathons, and if you're running 2 miles a day, and then when you work out, and pretty soon you're running 5 miles a day or 10 miles a day. If you just run the same mile every day,
you're not going to grow.
You'll stay in shape, but you're not going to get any better. And that was really the key. Try and find the place. You know, I find with a lot of comics now, they find a niche audience and then they stay there.
Yeah.
You know, I remember one time I said, book me at All Roberts University. I just want to see if I could play it. And it was tricky, but it wasn't impossible.
Right.
You know, because it was, here is an audience that was so different. Okay, what do they think is funny? Okay, so you just get a sense of a cross-section of what
America
wants.
How much of an adjustment will you make during the show? I mean, that's why, you know, a lot of times stand-ups don't understand that acting and stand-up are two completely different disciplines, and it's why some stand-ups are good actors and some aren't. Because in acting, in stand-up, you have to bifurcate your mind. So you're telling the joke, but you have to be listening to what's happening. Well, and you can't do that as an actor.
Comedians make good actors. Actors rarely make good comedians.
Right. Because, why do you think that is?
Because they're conscious of how they look on stage. You know, if you're a comedian, when I see pictures of myself people have taken, I'm embarrassed. I look stupid. I'm making a stupid face. You know, as an actor, you're always conscious. Is this my right side? Are they seeing my best side? Yeah. Am I doing this? So I would see comics work, and it'll be turn on stage as if they were watching themselves from the audience, you know? And I don't mean that as a put down of actors. Right. It's just a different feel.
Yeah.
You're supposed to, your reactions are different.
But you also have to be listening to what, you know, and different comics approach this differently. If the audience isn't going down this road, you want to go where you're talking about bottles of water, let's say.
Right, yeah.
Will you pull out of that material and go in a different vein? Sure. Or will you stick to your guns and go, what? It's take it or leave it, people.
Well, two schools of it. There are people who are take it or leave it, and there are people who are, you know, there are nights when I amuse myself and I enjoy that. And then there are nights when, okay, this is a job. Mm. I'm doing the Hewlett-Packard corporate event.
Yeah.
And I've got to do material that's going to work to this crowd.
Right.
A lot of people don't know this. Well, I'm an artist, man, so I just do it. Well, right. All right, fine.
Yeah.
I mean, there's really two different.
Yeah, I adjust. I mean, you know, especially for the corporate stuff. You know, I'll eventually weave in my stuff. And it's an interesting psychological battle because it's almost like carrots and ice cream feeding a baby, right? You give them what they want and then you give them what you want.
But then you get into that. I remember once I did one for Knoll Furniture, Chicago Theater. Place is packed with all 3,000 Knoll Furniture people. So I said to the guy before I went on stage, I said, is there a chair around here? So It was one of those metal folding chairs. I said, take all the screws out of that chair so when I touch it on stage, it'll fall apart. So I put it out there, and Case, I think, was their big, rival.
Right.
So I'm stopping, I could have an old friend, oh, this is the new Case office chair. Boo. And I touch it, and it falls apart, and they go, they're falling on the floor. And I realize, I got nothing that can follow. They're just, oh, my God, oh, the Case, oh, woo! And now they're up on they're standing, they're applauding in the. I'm getting a standing ovation. One joke in,
so
and then I
go,
"Hey, do you see this? The president? We want more Case. I don't have any more Case. I'm out of Case jokes. Okay, it's the only. I should have saved that to the end.
But that speaks to a larger point about comedy and audiences. Like, do you give them? And you obviously don't want to, but like. You know, it's like, you know, the jokes about differences between men and women and all that, they're good, they have their place, but like, do you give people what they want and what they're comfortable with? How far is it in an art, and do you bring them out of their comfort zone and sort of go into areas where, oh, I'm not sure I want to talk about abortion?
It all depends who you are.
Right.
To me, look, I'm a comedian, I'm there to please the audience, it's real simple. Write joke, tell joke, get check.
Yeah.
It's simple.
Yeah.
Am I trying to educate? You know, I always tell comedians, sometimes I see comics who put their personal beliefs in front of the joke. They're so anxious to get out that they are a Democrat or a conservative or a liberal. You sped past the joke to get to your point.
So, I mean, when you go to Emerson as a freshman, you said you noticed they didn't have any comedy or comedy courses. Were you actively thinking, comedy now, this is what I want to do? How did that sort of
I thought I would do it until I couldn't do it, until I had to get a job or something of that nature. I did a lot of the open mic nights. I mean, back in 69 and 70, 71, it was, you know, every college would put a candle in the cafeteria and that would become the two-toed cafe on Saturday nights.
Right.
And, you know, guys would come on and sing anti-Vietnam songs or whatever it might be. And I would usually MC and do some comedy. And I thought, okay. And it seemed like a fun way to make a living. And I thought I would do this, like I said, until, okay, you got to stop now. Okay, this isn't working.
Yeah.
I mean, I you know, when
do you
I
have any hell gigs, like where you just like,
oh,
you
a million know, hell gigs. Yeah. I mean, I've talked about those. Yeah. I mean, I used to sleep in an alley near 44th and 9th. And it was Dyke's Lumberyard was across the street. And I can remember sleeping in, I would just go there and sleep in that alley. And I remember in the alley one night, and maybe where that door is, about 5 feet away, there's some guy with a prostitute and they're arguing. And then she's, and I'm like, is this my life now? I'm sleeping in the alley.
Shortly after I lived.
You know, and I thought, really? Is this what my life is? Because, you know, it was at the point where my friends were getting jobs and getting cars and making car payments. I remember my friend Louis bought a house. I went, wow, he got a house.
I'm sleeping in an alley.
You know, I mean, but it's okay.
Well, but I know that feeling when I left Wall Street to do this full time, I unraveled my life. I actually moved to New Rochelle where you were born and lived and moved to a rooming house.
Yeah.
And I had a little 10 by 12 room. I had a 2-bedroom apartment on the Upper West Side that I owned, the cufflinks, the gold watch, the whole nine yards. And I chucked it all in the car and started over. And I immediately started to have doubts once I was in it because, man, it was not glamorous. You go 3 hours.
Yeah.
I worked at Joker's Wild in New Haven. I don't know if you remember that club. I opened for Elaine Boozler. I just saw her recently.
Yeah, Elaine.
And did a TV show with her. And I go in, it's February. And the guy who owns the club is notoriously, at the time, like a Coke guy, like Del Coke out of the Coke. I walk in, I go, I'm looking for the owner. Who are you? I go, I'm the opening act. He goes, oh, yeah. He goes, you want a shot? I go, no. He goes, you want to do some blow? I go, no. He goes, what are you, a pussy? That's what he said to me. Yeah. This is the owner.
Right.
I go, no, I just, you know, I'm going to put myself. I go on stage. It's February. Everybody's wearing their jackets. The guy wasn't paying his heating bill.
Wow.
So there was no heat. You could see people's breath. And he was doing a show and didn't care. And Elaine went up and did her thing. And I come off stage at the end of the weekend. It was 5 shows, $50 a show, $250. And he stiffs me on my money.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, the bouncer goes, oh, he left. He didn't leave us a check. Come back. So I call the guy. I go back the next week. He goes, come on Saturday. I have a check for you. I go back to pick up my check. Stiffs me again.
Oh, yeah.
I call him. Long story short, I get him on the phone. He goes, hey, he goes, you think you're going to get paid? He goes, if it's between you and the oil company, you lose. You and the gas company, you lose. And click, I have the phone. And those moments make you go, what am I doing? Why am I, is this dream worth it? Is this passion worth it?
Oh, I had a million of them. I went all the way to Latham, New York from Latham Theater from L.A.
Mm.
And boy, I get there and I literally get out of the cab and it's boarded up. The guy, they didn't even tell me they closed the place like 3 or 4 days earlier. And it was, that's it. Now you're broke and you're in a town. You spent
4 hours driving.
Yeah, you're flying. You know. Yeah, I mean, there's a million of those. Just heartbreaking.
But do you think it's sort of God's, whatever you want to call it, sort of the universe's way of testing your mettle to see how badly you want this?
Well, I suppose you could say that. Yeah, I mean, that's all part of it. I mean, if you realize you use everything, you know. It's a bit like an organic farmer. You recycle every one of those incidents became a story for a podcast or talk show or something of that nature.
Right. I mean,
that's pretty much what the business is. That's why it pays a lot at the end because you don't have anything at the beginning. You know, at the beginning, you go, can I have something to eat? Get out of here, you bum. I go to the restaurant. Oh, no charge for you, Miss Lano. I love this. Yeah, it's a steak. No charge. Yeah, well, I don't need the steak now. I could have used the steak 25 years ago.
I think you had a great line that you don't get paid the money, you get paid to do what you do on stage, is to put up with all the nonsense off stage.
Well, that's what it is. That's really what it is. Sure.
And then, so, you know, at that point, you're sort of chump, but you start to see progress and you're going to New York and you're getting this, you know, you're working at the improv, which is a big thing. And at what point do you go, you know what, adios, Boston, I've kind of outgrown my roots.
You know what's interesting? Again, a different time. When I came to Los Angeles, when I lived in Boston, for about 18 months, I was the only comedian I had ever met.
Really?
So consequently, I mean, I would see comedians on stage, or I'd see famous comedians like Robert Klein would come into town. I would go see him.
But Steve Sweeney and those guys.
No, I didn't. No, I was a little before them. Things, you know, I'm old. I'm 63.
Okay.
So this is 69, 70.
Okay.
So I never really met any. So I actually thought I was pretty good.
Yeah.
I wasn't. And it wasn't until I came to Los Angeles, I went, oh, my God. I mean, literally on audition night, there was Letterman
and Robin Williams and you know, a bunch of other guys, and it was like, oh wow, these are guys like me
that came from other parts. Did that push you to up your game?
Well, yeah, I push up, but I was confident enough at that point. I've been doing it for 18 months, so I didn't get discouraged.
Right.
I didn't, you know, I feel sorry for kids that get off the bus from Iowa or whatever, and they walk into the improv, and they've got to follow Jerry Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. Yeah. You know, but I was following a singer and this and a, and, oh, I was the only one getting laughs because there were no other comics. Right. You know.
So it creates a level of confidence. Yeah. And then, so you're, when you're doing that, I mean, do you just, I mean, was there a set or a moment or a, you know, for some people where you go, all right, I think I got this. I think not that I figured it out forever, but like, I'm going to be good at this or I'm good at this. Was there like a defining set or do you remember?
You know, sort of, I was really lucky. I never had any big break. I had a series of little breaks that added up together to become, I guess, what you call a big break. I mean, I don't know if there's any one moment where you can pinpoint it. Maybe playing Carnegie Hall. That was kind of interesting. You know, I played Carnegie Hall, and my mother never really understood. The day she died, she didn't quite understand how, you know. So I'm on stage at Carnegie Hall, and I see my mom four rows back in the middle. My mom was from Scotland. Hmm. Never, the worst thing you could do to my mother was call attention to yourself. Oh, my God. My mother would never raise her hand. So there were like five guys sitting behind my mom who had seen me on Letterman. And, you know, it was that era when people kind of knew your routine, so they're waiting for it again.
Yeah, you were appointment television.
Yeah, so I started to do them, and I hear them laughing. And my mother turns on and goes, shh, shh. And I go, Ma, don't shush people. And I'm like, oh, my mother's so embarrassed. Now she's been singled out in Carnegie Hall. Oh, my God. That was like the worst. Oh my God.
You had some great jokes. You had the thing about they were worried that the remote control was going to set things on fire.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Just, you know, I used to do a lot of parent stuff. But so I don't know if there's any one moment that you could say.
I mean, almost artistically and creatively, like, you know, where you sort of feel like, okay, I got this. I know how to, you know, because it's every night it's so different. And you're only as good as your last set. And you're only as good as your last
That's
joke.
What I am a huge believer in low self-esteem. You know what I mean? The only people on high self-esteem are actors and criminals.
Come on, but I mean, look, I think being a comic...
I mean, I'm dyslexic, and my mother would always say, you're going to have to work twice as hard as the other kids just to get the same thing.
Do you still deal with that today? Is that...
Well, I realize I have to work twice as hard as the other kids to get the same thing. Right. And that works for me. And it has always worked for me. I don't know if it's a truism or whether it's just lucky, but... You know, I always tell the story about when I first got the Tonight Show, there were three or four other talk shows coming out at the same time. And I was home writing my monologue. I turn on the news to see what's gone. And I see a competing talk show host at the Laker game. And I go, well, that guy's not going to have a monologue tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I turned on the show and he didn't. I mean, he had a short monologue, right. But it was just, you know, there was not a lot of in-depth. And I thought, okay, well, this is how, so if I just do this and work real hard.
Yeah.
I was lucky. I never got sidelined by alcohol or drugs or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, I feel sorry for people who do. Yeah. And most comedians, I find, either are off the charts, drugs, coke, or totally abstain.
Yeah.
Seinfeld, me, bunch of nothing, never, ever.
Yeah.
And it's either one extreme or the other.
Right about that.
And neither one is creatively, I don't know, creatively both ways. I don't know any comedian that's in the middle. I don't know anybody that's moderately doing any of those things.
Recreational.
And being a comedian.
But I feel like, you know, in pursuing something like this, are we insecure that we need that sort of to be? I've said this on my act on stage, to come out in front of a group of strangers and need to make them laugh. What does that say about me?
I think most comics will tell you the recognition from a complete stranger is so much better than a family or friend saying that was really good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the exact opposite of.
Right.
I mean, that's just the way it is.
And that's dysfunctional on some level, I think, don't you?
Oh, it's dysfunctional on many levels. You happen to live at a time when that is particularly advantageous. I mean, if this was the time of the Renaissance, for example, and the soldiers, who's making the people laugh? It's that guy. Kill him. Kill him. Just cut that guy's head off. I mean, because there's no advantage to having a funny soldier. So just kill that guy because he's disturbing the other soldiers and keeping them from concentrating.
I remember getting that recognition. I would watch The Tonight Show with Johnny, you know, as a kid, and Buddy Hackett or Rodney's right. on or whoever. And then I'd go into a school and I'd start saying some of Rodney's jokes right. and my friends would laugh and I'd be like, whoa. And they'd think I was, and then I started to be funny myself.
Right.
And I never had the inkling that I was going to do this full time. And people say when I was a lawyer that they know you're going to do it. I'm like, I don't know. And I think that there's some light went off. And when you did that joke of mine on the Sunday, even though you did it,
yeah,
I think the connection was I created something out of thin air and someone reacted to it.
Yeah.
And that was moving on a big level.
Yeah.
You know?
Most comics would tell you there's no plan B. When I hear comics go, well, I'm going to go to Hollywood, and if I don't make a comedian, my other plan, and I just say, you're not going to make it. There is no plan B. If you actually have a backup plan, then you're not going to make it.
Right.
You paint yourself into a corner.
Right.
You literally get to the point where, and try not to take a job that's not a comedy job. I mean, I used to live on the street, and I lived on the street when I came out here because I knew if I became a waiter or got a job, I would have to be at that job. And yeah. then I would want a car, and then I would make payments, and I couldn't go to auditions or travel because I had to make the payment on the car. I would become dependent. Although I have many material things now, I didn't have any because I knew if I had one, I would want two, and then I would want three, and then I want four.
Well, that's dedication yeah. to your art. I mean, that's
well, I
that
guess
is.
You'd call it art. I mean, being from whatever. New England, that always sounds
yeah,
sort of
whatever, yeah,
kind
yeah.
of artsy-fartsy yeah. a little bit. But yeah, I mean, that's that I think is the real
thing. But trick. What are you doing? How are you making money out here when you get out here then? What are you doing? Some little gigs here and there, picking up $50 here and there and just scraping
yeah,
by.
Little gigs here and there. That's pretty much
staying with friends.
I crashing. Used to sleep on the stairs of the Comedy Store. I used to stay there.
Did you really?
Yeah. Friendly waitresses, you know, you get friendly, you could crash on their couch. Los Angeles, so you could sleep outside because it was nice out.
So would you have like a sleeping bag? You just crash and then boom.
No, I never sleep in. You just sort of you sit down and you go to sleep. It's not that
yeah, but wait, you're saying you're reacting to my question like it's a well, that no, seems I, like you're sleeping I mean, on the street is an amazing
no, I got picked up twice. They used to pick you up for vagrancy. In fact, I don't know if they do that anymore.
I don't know.
They call it homeless yeah. now. But I got picked up twice by the cops for no visible means of support. And they were very nice to me. What they would do is they'd pick you up at 9 o'clock and you'd have to sit in the back of the police car for their entire shift. And then they'd drop you off at dawn.
Jesus.
And then they'd see you a couple weeks. You still get in the back and they'd drive you around. I mean, they're always very nice to me. They never mistreated me.
But it allowed you to
that's
sort of
okay.
focus
that's
on the
okay.
stand-up.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, let you focus on the stand-up. Yeah, and you just... You take every job. You go anywhere where there might be. Yeah. I can remember going to the Improv in New York at, like, auditions would start after the regular show at, like, 11:30. And there would be people lined up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I would get in line, and you'd see a guy in front of you go, screw this, I'm not fine. Oh, he dropped out.
Yeah.
I move up.
Yeah.
Oh, that guy dropped. It was a matter of waiting out the clock on all the people who really didn't want to do this.
I can't tell you how aggravating. Young comics will say to me, hey, can you put a word in with so-and-so at such and such a club? Give me a scene. Yeah. Well, he liked me, said to come and hang around, and you know, but I can't hang around. I can't hang around late. I got, yeah. And I finally said to one kid, you know, that's really an imposition on me. Like, if I put my neck out and I say to somebody, you know, take a look at this guy, he's worth being in the club, and then do you think they're going to hand this to you?
Yeah.
I said,
yeah.
You've got to want it more than life itself.
Oh, yeah, I get that a lot. You know, I want to be a comedian, but I don't want go on the road. I just want to do TV. That's very nice. Okay, welcome to Showbiz. But I don't want to do this kind of gig. Well, no, thank you, really. Well, good. Let me know how that works out.
I was in Indiana. It was headlining, and the middle act was so aggravating. I went to the club. I never did this before and said, this guy's got to go. Find somebody else. We drive from the hotel to the club, and he would just basically crap all over stand-up the whole time.
Yeah.
And I finally said, hey, you know, I left like a whole like real think this is a kind of a cool thing.
Yeah.
And it was just so negative. LA guy, this is just something on the way to something else.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that was always a great thing about Jerry Seinfeld. Jerry Seinfeld, he treats it as an art. He treats it as a craft. This is the end product.
Yeah.
The end product is the stand-up. You keep honing it and honing it. I'm always amazed that when you're a stand-up, you owned the Tonight Show or the Letterman Show, whatever it is, for 6 or 8 minutes. Mm. You're the only thing on the network that night.
Yeah.
Yet, as an actor, you're playing third prisoner on a Law & Order episode. And nobody really reckoned who's that. But I know so many comedians that thought, oh, that was so much better.
Right.
than being a stand-up.
You acted and
I did a few movies and things,
but it never grabbed the way stand-up did.
No, not the way stand-up does. No, God, no. It was all no.
Isn't there a story about they were casting and they wanted a Jay Leno type, but not you?
Yeah, I've had that happen. Yeah, yeah.
Lewis Black has a story like that too. They literally want to build a show
around. I went in once. I go into this audition at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I walk in, and it's all kind of short guys with glasses. And every time the casting director would come out, he'd look at me and go, next, the next guy. And there were 50 guys. So finally, 3 o'clock, I've been there 8 hours. And each time he'd come out, he'd just look at me. So finally, everybody's gone but me. And he comes out and he goes, you want to come in? I go, yeah. He goes, let me ask you something. You really think you look like Woody Allen? I go, no, I don't think my agent called and said that you're looking for comedians. No, we're looking for a Woody Allen lookalike. You know, I said, well, he didn't tell. I said, I'm sorry. And they said, looking for comics. That's why he came down. But this guy got more and more disgusted and mad every time he came out and saw me sitting there. Because, you know, I don't have a chance of getting this part. What are you wasting my time? But I sat there for 8 hours, nine till 3 or 4, whatever it was.
You know, I love watching you talk about cars. I don't know if you know this, but you almost change a little bit. You kind of melt into the subject.
I like cars.
Well, not just on the show, but on Jay Leno's Garage.
Yeah,
watching you were talking about the Jaguar XKE.
XKE, right.
Is it 1963 that you bought for this woman?
Yeah, right, 50
years.
And yeah, yeah.
Just you kind of light up. Where did the car thing come from?
Well, I've always been interested in cars.
When you were a kid, from your dad?
Yeah, well, anything that rolls and explodes and makes noise. But like comedy, it's a solitary pursuit.
And you like that?
Yeah,
it gets you out of your head as a comic, I guess.
I think I'm a team player, but I don't really want to be on any teams.
Yeah.
I never really played baseball, football. I didn't mind boxing. I didn't mind individual. I was annoyed by the fact that I don't get ahead unless somebody throws me the ball. Can I just take the ball and do something with it? I have to wait for somebody to throw me the ball.
Is it because you're impatient or you don't like one-on-one individual competition?
Well, I move at my own, I used to be in a comedy group, and the most frustrating thing about it was, hey, I got us a gig every day next week. Oh, let's just work 3 nights, man. We got gigs every day. Mm. No, I don't want to. And it just got to be. And I left. I said, I'm going to do this by myself. It's too.
So is it about your nature that you like to sort of be in control of your destiny and that?
Yeah, yeah. But stand up is a solitary.
How do you deal with the subjectivity of the business? You don't have to anymore. I mean, you're a big star, but that was always.
What's the subjectivity of the business?
In the sense of I came out of Wall Street, right? If you did A, B, and C, you kind of got D, right? You got promoted. You got the partner. You got the office. Whatever. In this business, you do everything right, but you're a couple inches too short, or there's subjective quality. You know, 4 people like you, but 1 out of the 5 doesn't, and so you can't, right?
Yeah, I've never been one. I don't.
Did that ever frustrate you? Did you ever deal with that? And sort of how'd you get your head around that?
I'm not someone that gets overly happy. I'm not someone that gets particularly depressed. I try to remain.
Really?
I keep the business. You know, there's a saying, it's like I always tell guys, you don't fall in love with a hooker, okay? I mean, that's show business is, it looks great, have fun, but really, you don't fall in love with a hooker. You know, when I go to comics houses and they have the pictures of them with every star they've ever met on the wall, and I go, you're going to get your heart broken, okay? Really, with all these, you come to my house, you couldn't tell I was a
show. What do you mean they're going to get their heart broken?
Well, because you're so close.
Tied into the idea of stardom.
You're so tied in. You're so enjoy it. It's fun.
But come on, you're a human being. You haven't had that moment where you're like, oh, I had it. It was so close. And sure. You go into a funk for whatever.
I'm sure I have.
No, I don't mean now. I mean before you're doing.
I had heartbreaking episodes when I was a kid.
I'm not talking about when you first started. You're at that place now where you're, you're Leno and sort of you're a major.
I guess you think if you ever think you're at that place, the real trick is to never think you're at that place. You know, when you think you're this person or that person, go to Tulsa, Oklahoma and play the theater, see how you do. Go to Branson, go to Vegas, go to, the big difference between audiences that watch something for free television and audiences that shell out $60 for a ticket. Yeah. There is a huge difference.
Yeah.
A huge. You know, I'm always amazed at comics that are witty and verbose on television. Then they go to a paying gig and, oh my God, they have
Nobody laughed at all. What happened? This stuff was so witty when I was talking to whoever it was. Right. It's a whole different world.
And they also don't want to pay their dues. I remember seeing a comic who got, I don't want to mention any names, a woman got fast-track trajectory on the SNL.
Yeah.
And became, and at the Catch on First Avenue. Louis Ferranda, I don't know if you remember Louis, but he runs Caroline's, right, he's been around forever in comedy, was the GM of the club. And she's on stage and somebody chatting down front. She's got a prime spot. It's like second spot up, right?
Yeah.
And some people are chatting. And she just couldn't, because she never paid her dues.
Yeah.
Hell gigs, the lady. She didn't know how to handle those people talking. So she did the, you know what she did? That the thing you never say, right? She goes, "You talking? I'm up here. Do you know who I am?" That was it. She lost the entire room and crashed. The
audience thinks as an individual.
Yes.
And you can't.
Oh, they have all the power. You just can't let them know.
No, that's
right. They're going to swallow you up like
exactly,
a shark.
Exactly.
They have all the power.
Yeah.
And in the middle of the show, an artificial leg gets put on the stage. This woman took her boyfriend's artificial leg off and put it on the stage.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
So the guy, he's a little buzzed, not saying super hammered, starts talking about it. It's like he lost it just below the knee, so it's kind of flapping around. Okay. And I brought him on stage for a couple of minutes, and I talked to him about his leg. And it was fascinating because you could feel the audience as one go through four different emotions. First, like, oh my God, there's an artificial leg. This is weird. Two, oh my God, this guy's got lost his leg. Ooh, should I laugh at this? And then he was so funny and loose about it, they completely opened up and it was phenomenal. And to see that old...
I worked a club once and I'm on stage. This was like a mob club. And I'm on stage and I hear a ruckus going on down there. And I hear like, "Wow!" You know, and I do a joke about it and I see this guy being dragged out. Well, Billy, the bouncer at this club, this guy gets seated in front of a pole. And he doesn't like his seat. And he starts arguing with him. Billy takes out a huge Bowie knife, stabs the guy right in the thigh, and cuts him maybe a foot long, 16-inch cut. The guy's screaming blood all over the place. They put him in a cab. I don't know anything about this till after the show. 6 months go by. I get a call from the club. And, "Hey, Jay, remember Billy, the bouncer? Remember Billy, the guy that helped you?" I wouldn't even help. "Remember that guy was talking and Billy stabbed him?" I go, "First of all, that didn't help me. That really didn't help me. I didn't know Billy stabbed him." "Well, anyway, Billy killed a guy and now the cops are hassling him. He wants to know if you can help him out." You know, and I remember saying to this guy, I said, "Why don't the cops go after real criminals instead of people like Billy?" And it's just, he goes, "Yeah." And he doesn't even get the joke. He doesn't get the iron. I said, I can't come. "He stabbed the guy, but he helped you." "Oh, he didn't help me. The guy set up a pole and he almost killed him. That didn't help me."
That's what these guys think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's hilarious. It's just hilarious.
Listen, I don't want to keep you much longer. I know you got to run. But listen, I got to ask you, modified, restored, explain to people, you know so much about cars.
Yeah.
And sort of watching you and listening and reading about you.
Well, there's original. Original is exactly as it came from the factory.
Right.
Then there's restored, which means it's taken back to what it looked like from the factory, but it's not original. It's restored, maybe using original parts, to look original.
Does it keep its value when you do that?
It depends. Some do. And then there's modified, where you put modern brakes on it or things of
which
that
nature.
Which
you've done to...
Yeah, we've done of all those things,
Do you have a favorite car in your collection?
Well, if I had a favorite car, I wouldn't have all these cars.
Yeah.
But the idea, when you work with your hands, you appreciate how easy it is to make money telling jokes.
Yeah.
I always remember back when I was a kid in the 70s, Suzanne Somers was on Three's Company.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some fight going on. And I remember her manager, at the time she was being offered $150,000 a week, which in the 70s was like almost $1 million.
Yeah.
And her manager said, "That's an insult." You know, and I thought, okay, you know, I never want to get to that point. So another story, the perfect example of why I'm working on cars, and I probably told this before, I had a guest on, a famous star, and during the break, he goes, "You know about cars?" "Hey, what's a good sports car? What's a cool car?" I said, "Well, this new Ferrari came out. It's pretty cool." And this guy says to me, yeah, but everybody's got a Ferrari. I said, first of all, everybody does not have a Ferrari. And if you ever say that publicly, you'll be killed. You'll be beaten. I said, you know, will you get out of town and just go do dinner theater or something?
Yeah.
Because you have no... Yeah. You have, so to me, when you work on with your hands and you make something, you realize most people work really hard for right. that.
Yeah.
You know, and the idea of when they... It's like when I do a live show, I try to do 90 minutes, maybe... close to 2 hours because people bought a ticket, give them their money's worth. Yeah. You know, these people are going, oh, just give them 45 and then get out, leave them wanting more. Well, they might want more, but now they're pissed because they paid a lot for yeah. what they got. So you just, you know, I used to love Alan King. Alan King used to do a great bit about, you know, some executive, some movie star, oh, they took time off from the movie because they're exhausted. They're exhausted. Meanwhile, some guy digging in a coal mine. Can I put my shovel? Like, get back in that hole, you son of a bitch. You know, how come a coal miner is never right, exhausted?
Exactly.
That's right. So, no, I never get to that
right.
point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I never use the word I'm tired. Right. I don't want, no.
For guys out there trying to get there, get down this road, whether it's comedy or anything.
You know something? It goes back to Dale Carnegie. Look him in the eye, shake hands. If there's somebody you want to meet, if you have an idol, approach that person normally. Don't look like a crazy person, you know. In the same way you approached me, when you approached me, I summed you up. Okay, this seems normal. This okay. Guy took the time to talk to me. I'll take time to talk to him. When I get those letters from, I live in Chicago. I'd like to be in show, but I don't want to stay here, though. I don't want to move to L.A. I'll politely answer their request.
Yeah.
And then this guy. But the kid said, I drove all the way from Chicago to talk to you about, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I look him in the eye and I'll take the time yeah. and go, oh, okay. And that's really how it works. It really, in a digital age when everything is social media, one-on-one contact is the person sizes you up. They yep. look normal. They feel funny. I mean, I can talk to people and sense. I've had writers come in and I can look at them and I sense that they're a good writer just by their yeah. the way they talk or the phraseology that they use. You,
yeah.
know, you can just tell.
Yeah. It's so true. And it's also sort of not take any gig you can get. I think you've said that in the past.
Take every gig there is. You know, take every gig there is and never ask how much it pays. Whatever it pays, that's the gig.
Sleep in an alley with a prostitute.
Yeah. You know, like when you did. You know, like people always say, I mean, I wasn't that long ago. I was in Vegas, and they said ticket sales are down. I said, okay, cut the price in half. I'll take less. Oh, and they were thrilled. Okay, they cut the price in half. Instead of $100, take it was $55. And it's sold out. Oh, okay, fine. So wow. take less. You know, and that's what it is. You know, it's about the work.
Yeah.
You know, don't get caught up on, you know, to me, these guys that have managers, and when my client is not going in, yes, he is. Yeah, I am. Okay, I have no pride. What's the gig? Tell me, we'll do it.
Did you ever keep in touch with any of the strippers you used to work with years ago?
You know, I remember Silver Moon was a girl. I remember she was. That's a hard life. You live on that stripper diet of Reese's peanut butter cups, grape soda, and pizza. And I remember a girl named Silver Moon, and she used to come out kind of naked with 2 6-guns, and she was a gymnast, and she could twirl, and she was like 19, and oh my God, perfect body. She came out to here when she was 28, and she called me up. She looked 45.
Did your parents know you were working those clubs? Did you just
yeah, sort of. They didn't. You know, it was all right.
This is unbelievable. Well, thanks, man. I really appreciate
it. Well, Paul,
this.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
All right, there you go. Jay Leno. Very, very cool to have him on. Please check out my one-man show, Paul McCurry's Permission to Speak. We're still running. It's at the Actors Temple Theater in New York City. If you're going to be in the area, come on by. And you get tickets at telecharge.com. Use the code PMFAN, you get 50% off. Appreciate you guys supporting the podcast, and we will see you next week.